joy for me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I'm knocking on heaven's door.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those nights.
Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
Hey, good evening, truth seekers. Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network, knocking on heaven's door indeed. Every once in a while I like to start the program with a different opening theme, and I think this is appropriate for tonight. A couple of breaking stories here. I love saying that. Breaking news here on the Malloy program. Michael Sneed, that's a woman. She's a columnist for the Sun-Times in Chicago. And just flashed across the wire here a few minutes ago. This. Michael Sneed, or she refers to herself as Sneed. Sneed hears rumbles. President-elect Barack Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, is reportedly on 21 different taped conversations by the feds dealing with his boss's vacant Senate seat. A lot of chit-chat? Hot air? Or trouble? Today, Rahm's been mum. Stay tuned. That's in the Chicago Sun-Times, and obviously what it's referring to is the Blagojevich situation. And again, we brought this up the other night, quoting a law professor, and it was on ABC News tonight. Is there really a case against Blagojevich? It's going to be hard to use. The consensus is starting to develop in certain areas of the defense lawyer community that it might be difficult to build a case based around the RICO laws or conspiracy laws where it concerns Blagojevich's conversations with whomever. Regarding his thoughts or his plans or his schemes to sell Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat. I don't know how this law works. I don't know how fine a point there has to be put on the prosecution. What constitutes evidence in a case like this? I do know that the criminal justice system in this country has gone straight to hell under George W. Bush. When you have murderous war criminals leading the country, then the entire criminal justice system collapses. It becomes easier to indict. It becomes easier to convict. Which sounds completely like a contradiction, but it's not. When there are criminals running the government and making the appointments to the Justice Department, obviously, they are appointing criminals. Look at some of the cases that have the whistleblowers, the firing of the federal attorneys, the governor of Alabama being jailed for what appears to be, I say appears, it's not, but appears to be the same thing that Blagojevich is accused of. So the whole system collapses when you have run-of-the-mill criminals at the top of the heap, but when you have war criminals who violate all law, domestic, foreign, international treaties, agreements, then kiss the whole thing goodbye. Seriously. Seriously. So Michael Sneed's, little drop-in in her column, I guess it'll be tomorrow, it'll appear in tomorrow's Sun-Times, that Rahm Emanuel, now if this is true, then say goodbye to Rahm Emanuel. I don't think that Barack Obama is going to want more focus on this. And this obviously is what is going on here. Barack Obama is being attacked by a pack of wild dogs. Now, the wild dogs may be justified in attacking. They may, you know, the wild dogs may say, hey, we're hungry. We want to rip and bite and tear. Let's get him. Let's get Barack Obama. Now I hear that his presumed nominee for Secretary of Agriculture has a major contributor who is also under investigation. I don't know, but it appears, doesn't it? Isn't it amazing how these things develop? Isn't it amazing? There is no way to stop there was no way to stop the candidacy of Barack Obama. Even though everything was tried against him, every conceivable dirty trick was tried against him, from race to gender to just everything, to his middle name. Jesus, God. Everything. And it didn't work. This is the next level of assault. And it's coming from so many different directions. And it's coming, when I say so many different directions, I mean it's all engineered by the neo-fascists in this country. The FreeRepublic.com psychopaths and the Rush Limbaugh idiocy and the major corporations, the usual sons of bitches who are determined to turn this country fascist. And Barack Obama, if he is going to continue in the mold of, say, a Bill Clinton, he just won't turn it fascist quick enough for these sons of bitches. If he turns it fascist at all, he may not. Barack Obama may be the man that says no, absolutely no. You never know. He is in a unique position in all of American political history. Here he is, Barack Obama, so-called African-American, and is now the president of the United States. If he wants to refer to himself as African-American, or if people of African descent want to refer to him that way, it's certainly not my call. I mean, if I call myself Italian-American, somebody wants to challenge it because I have an Irish name, I pretty much would just give him the finger and say, get out of my face, you know, go away. So, okay, African-American. He's in a unique position. And it's too scary for too many factions in this country. So the attacks on Obama, have you noticed how they and the media go right along with it, don't they? Elevating Rod Blagojevich's phone calls. I don't know what Blagojevich did. I think he's a punk two-bit hustler. That's all. Just a punk. I mean, anybody get on the phone who finds himself in a position that Blagojevich does, hey, goddamn, I got something cool to sell, man. Hey, woo, I'm going to get this effort to do this and that MFer. And hey, what about, that's his wife in the background. Hey, what about that other effer? You know, I mean, they're just a couple of swine. Okay, so what? And the ongoing efforts by media, remember how they tried to link Barack Obama to Jeremiah Wright. Remember how they tried to link him to Bill Ayers? I mean, just on and on and on. It doesn't stop. This is what happens in the United States of America on the cusp of national socialism, i.e. corporatism, i.e. fascism. This is what happens when somebody is elected president, for Christ's sake, who was not supposed to be. He simply wasn't. Now, I know a lot of people, myself included, still maintain there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, and that's 98% true. But you have a few people in both parties who just don't quite go along with it. The two women senators, Olympia Snowe and who's the other female senator from Maine? Olympia Snowe and... who's the other one, Kathy? Drawing a complete blank. They don't go along in the mold. Maybe Barack Obama doesn't. So what do you do with someone like Barack Obama who wins and wins handily and starts, oh my God, inspiring people? You come after him with your razors and your pins and you try to eliminate him with 1,000 cuts.
Trust my ears, I don't believe my eyes. I will not fall in love, I cannot despair. It's hard to grab the toys, so easy to forget.
It is 21 past the hour. Now, this thing we mentioned about Rahm Emanuel and Blagojevich, it's now been picked up by the L.A. Times, and they are adding this. Last Thursday, Obama said he had never spoken to Blagojevich about the Senate vacancy and was, quote, confident that no representatives, end quote, of his, Obama's, had engaged in any deal-making over it with the governor or his team. Obama also pledged that in the, quote, next few days, end quote, he would explain what contacts his staff may have had with the governor's office about that seat. Rahm Emanuel, an Illinois congressman who has long been close to both Blagojevich and Obama, has refused to answer questions about any involvement he may have had with the Blagojevich camp or the Senate pick. A spokesman for Emanuel also declined to comment. Now, let me make sure I have this. What's the date today, Kathy? The 16th? Okay, this is the L.A. Times story is 3 days old. But Sneed, the columnist for the Sun-Times, is reporting, I believe, tonight that the actual number, more than 20 contacts between, or at least 20 times, Rahm Emanuel shows up on these tapes that the feds made when they were tapping Blagojevich's phone. So, again, it stands to reason, I think, that the chief of staff of the president-elect, who was a senator, would have conversations with the governor of the state where the president-elect was senator about filling the seat. I mean, they're not just going to walk away and say, oh, there's an empty seat. You take care of it, Rod. See ya. Bye. Of course there are going to be conversations. But the sinister tone to all of this, sinister in the way it's casually or offhandedly reported, sometimes that sinister little bit is there by implication. You understand what I mean? We shall watch this and report. Now, another story that we have here. About 6 or 7 years ago, when we were doing our little radio show for IE America, this is before Air America, we were carried on a Miami station, and we developed a big listenership at the Miami Detention Center. The jail, kind of like the county jail, the city jail. A lot of federal prisoners are held there. All sorts of people are held in that jail. And we were picked up inside the jail on AM radio. And I started getting a series of letters from a young guy who was a prisoner there, Victor Lopez. And He wrote, as a matter of fact, probably over the past 6, 7 years, I'll bet you, what, Kathy, 100 letters? And I didn't respond in personal letters that much, maybe a couple of times. But what we did, after listening to Victor's story about how he wound up there, and the fact that he was alone, nobody to talk to, they were going to send him from Miami down to the Virgin Islands to where his crime had been committed, floating checks, kiting checks. And they're going to transfer him down to the Virgin Islands, which made it difficult, the American Virgin Islands, made it very difficult for Victor to get any kind of legal representation. As a young kid, well, not a kid, I mean, he was, what, 21, 20, 20, 19? How old was he, 18? He was a teenager, wasn't he? Yeah. So he wrote, he wrote and told me, hey, we love your show here in jail. We applaud, you know, we hoop and holler when you say this or say that. And he was, I hate this term, but he was a fan of the program. And over the course of a year or so, I got a bunch of letters from Victor. And then I got a letter from him. He said a judge was about to order his transferal out of the continental United States down to the American Virgins. And he asked me for a favor, the only favor he ever asked me for. Would I write a letter to the judge that was had the power to send him to the Virgin Islands and plead Victor's case that he gets to stay at the Miami Detention Center while his case worked its way through the court system. So I did. They're called good boy letters, and I wrote one. And I don't know to the extent to which the judge paid any attention to it, but shortly thereafter, Victor notified me that he was being sent to the Virgin Islands, to a jail there. And it was going to be extremely difficult for him to mount a defense. And he didn't really have a defense. He admitted to everything. He'd kited some checks. And when he first called me, he had already been sentenced, I believe. It's just hard for me to remember all the details. But so he was going to be sent down to the American Virgins. And right after the break here, I'll finish this story because I think you're going to find it extremely interesting. This is Nova M. I'm Mike Malloy.
Mike Malloy Show, you are now entering a flying monkey free zone.
It is 26 before the hour. So anyway, back to Victor Lopez. Just to recap very quickly, 6-7 years ago, we were working for IE America, Kathy and me, and had this young guy, 18, 19 years old, listening from the Miami Detention Center in Florida, where he was serving time for passing bad checks in the British American Virgin Islands. And as it turned out, he got sent back there while a decision was made on what his sentence was going to be. That's starting to come back to me now. He was facing 6 or 7 years in prison, and he was kind of stuck. He was literally an orphan. He had tried to get his life in shape. He was 18, 19 years old and written some bad checks in the islands for a little business that he had started, I believe, if I remember correctly. And nobody was showing him any mercy at all. So he, in writing to me, I think one time I just either asked him if there was something we could do, and he said it'd be nice if he got letters from people, if people would write to him. Because nobody, you know, nobody knew where he was. No, he didn't have any family, didn't have any friends, didn't have anybody. He was writing to a talk show host. So we had kind of a tacky website at the time, not like what we have now. And we put it up as, what did we used to call that, Kathy, an action alert? We put up Victor's mailing address in Miami first and asked people over the air. We just said, you know, the young kid, if you feel inclined, write to him. Well, all of a sudden, Victor started getting mail that it just blew him away. He wrote back to us and he said, I don't know how many letters he got, but it was enough to just overwhelm him from people out in the world who were writing to Victor, who had heard, and not just people here. I think he got letters from all over the globe, because even back then we were carried on the internet. Well, his transfer came through and they sent him to the Virgins, and, I think we put up his new address, didn't we, in the Virgin Islands, and the letters kept coming. He didn't get the deal that he wanted. He wound up not having to serve 6 or 7 years, but damn near. To make a long story short, one of the people who wrote to him was a woman named Elaine, and I don't want to say her last name, in North Carolina. And she and Victor established a good relationship. And when he was released, he went to live with her, and she adopted him. He enrolled in college in North Carolina. He got a couple of part-time jobs. He started doing those things that that people do who want to succeed. Victor wants to be a journalist. Some of the letters he wrote to me over all those years were extremely touching. They may not have been grammatically worth an A in a college writing course, but they were extremely touching. And we used to read some of them on the air, I think, didn't we, Kathy? Yeah. And Kathy and I would talk privately about these letters, about, you know, this kid really has, he's got the thing that you can't learn, I don't think, in a writing class. He had that soul. He had that soul connection, that ability to connect with the reader. And like I say, Elaine wrote to him, and a couple other people established long-term relationships with this kid. And he finally got out, and he came back to the States, went to North Carolina. Elaine paid for his travel, I believe. I've never spoken with Elaine. And I've only spoken with Victor, what, Kathy, two or three times in the whole time we've known him. It's been an over-the-air, over-the-internet, email, and snail mail kind of relationship between Victor and me. I know what he looks like. He sent me a picture one time. Good-looking young guy. We almost got together here in Atlanta, but we were going out of town, I think. What, weren't we, Kathy? Something. He was in North Carolina, and he was going to make a trip down here, but it just didn't work. Eventually, we'll meet. Eventually, Victor and I will meet. The people who wrote to him, I always thought it was an act of just decency to respond to something I put up on my website, and then to establish a relationship with Victor over the years, writing back and forth. And the people who stayed with it, the people who wrote to him, I think he must have answered every single letter. I mean, when you're doing time in prison, there's not a whole lot of other things you can do. So I get an email tonight from Elaine. Here's what it says. Dear Mike and Kathy, thought you'd like to know that Victor won the Nation Magazine College Student Essay Contest. He's a little excited. You can read it at the Nation website. Go to thenation.com, click on Student Nation. Happy holidays, Elaine, North Carolina. So I went there and clicked on Student Nation. And it says, this essay is the college winner of the nation's third annual student writing contest. It's titled Transcending Trauma by Victor Lopez. And I am just blown away. Absolutely blown away. That a kid who, I mean, didn't have a chance. Anybody who would have looked at his profile, his rap sheet, his legal or illegal history would look, oh, well, this kid's down the pipes. This one's never, just another kid that's going to wind up gone. That's it. No story here. Move on. And Victor said, no, hell no. And there were several people, the main one being Elaine, who also said, no, hell no. And provided the support needed for Victor to pull his own self. I, you know, nobody has, I don't think Victor would take a handout or charity. Now, the reason I bring this up is because, I want to read the essay to you that he wrote. And I guess I'll save it for the bottom of the hour coming up, about 45 minutes from now. In the meantime, just go to thenation.com and click on the up in the directory bar. You'll find it. Go to Student Nation and click. And the college winner is there and the high school winner is there. And Victor Lopez is the college winner. And he wrote me an email. He's at work, but this is what he said. Mike and Kathy, I'm at work, but Mom, Elaine, told me I just won the Nation Writing Contest. My last day for the semester was yesterday. I'd been having some depression, thinking about the past, and then Elaine called me on my way to work. And then he mentioned some, some personal stuff. I'm now entering my fourth semester in a few weeks. I make human mistakes, spend too much money at times, and stay up too late. Mom says I'm only allowed to study. LOL. I hope this makes you proud. Your friend, Victor. Me proud? Yeah. It sure enough does. So I just, just had to share that with you because a lot of people who listen to this program now remember Victor Lopez. I think didn't Marge write to Victor, Kathy? I think Marge did. Some of our long-term listeners, people who've been hanging with this program, I don't know why, for the past 6 or 7, 8 years, wrote to Victor. And, this kid has won the nation's college essay contest. I mean, come on! This is thenation.com! The Nation magazine! He won it! Unbelievable stuff. So, it's real nice every once in a while to report or to talk about something good. You know what I'm saying? All right, we have a break here. When we come back, we'll start talking about stuff bad again, okay? Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Your host for a Peance Freeance Future, it's Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. We'll do Victor Lopez's Nation College Student Winning Essay at the bottom of the hour coming up. But another reason I mention that is for all the people who may still be hanging with the program who helped this kid by writing to him. I mean, I can't, I don't have any words to express the gratitude that I feel to reach out like that and just pull somebody out of the muck, back from the brink. Just that you've never met. Just by writing to him, just by connecting with him. I'm really, it energizes me because so much of what, we talk about these days is not really happy stuff, So when something like this develops, I think that anyone who was involved over the past 5, 6, 7 years in just writing to Victor. Or I think Elaine used to send him pocket money that he could use in the commissary. And when he got out, she adopted him. And he's a college student, and he won the college essay writing contest for the nation, for God's sake. Whew. Right before the program, the other bit of breaking news, Bjorn sent this in. Apparently, the Marine Corps Air Ground Combat Center, Provost Marshal, that's the head of the unit of military police, and this is for California, listen well, it's for everybody, and the local California Highway Patrol Office will begin working together within the next couple of days and through the holiday season in a joint effort to reduce accidents and drinking and driving. The combined cooperation between the Marine Corps military police and the state enforcement officers will begin somewhere along Highway 62. The California Highway Patrol will set up DUI roadblocks with the presence of military police. A clear violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. What are they preparing us for, Truth Seekers? Huh? Now, that was posted at rawstory.com, and they got it from bbvm.wordpress.com. And the larger story here, let me see here. Democracy depends upon abiding by the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, I challenge the writer of this. Who wrote this? BBVM. Therefore, I challenge anyone to go out there and make a citizen's arrest of the California Highway Patrol officers. Then call 911, have a sheriff come out, and take charge of your prisoner. Just kidding, of course. But a very brazen citizen legally could attempt to do such a thing, but don't even think about it. There is much talk that this joint effort or mutual cooperation between the military and the California Highway Patrol is going to be very intimidating. They, the people who are expressing this concern, as I, they are very concerned. The California Highway Patrol is going through with this action. It's not really clear what the specific role of the military police will be. To assist, to observe, to train, to make a strong military presence, to take charge of military offenders obtained by the CHP. Nevertheless, whatever, it's unconstitutional. I contacted the Morongo, California Highway Patrol office. The dispatcher said the program will be in effect tonight. This is a couple of nights. This is December 14th. When I asked where it was going to be, the dispatcher said, call back after 7 p.m. I politely protested that these DUI check stops are public information. She said, I have to speak with the public affairs officer, blah, 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 blah. The Posse Comitatus Act provides, quote, it shall not be lawful to employ any part of the Army of the United States as a posse comitatus or otherwise for the purpose of executing the laws, except in such cases and under such circumstances as such employment of said forces may be expressly authorized by the Constitution or by act of Congress. Well, isn't this interesting? Spokesperson says that Highway 62 is one of the most dangerous highways in California. Well, it goes on. It goes on. It goes on. So, for people living in California, this has a direct effect. For the rest of us in the rest of the country, it... I don't know, is this the first time that Marine military police have been used to handle DUI checks? I realize military police are not like combat soldiers, Marines, although they go through basically the same training. They are in law enforcement, but it's not domestic law that they are charged to enforce. It's military law, isn't it? Things are getting curiouser and curiouser here in the good old U.S. of A., aren't they, truth seekers? If you are listening in California, have you heard about this? Has it gotten very much attention? Is it no big deal? All right, we have a few more reactions to the shoe-throwing incident. And what else do we have tonight? Oh, yeah, the work of the Federal Reserve today and comments on that from our economic affairs correspondent. So stick around. And your phone calls, of course. Stick around. All right? I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. 6 and a half past the hour. This is the Malloy Program on Nova M Radio. Andre writes in regarding the shoe tossing by the Iraqi journalist at the war criminal George Bush the other day. Andre writes, you know, Mike, the slow reaction by the Secret Service is a direct reflection of how much this administration, this regime, just doesn't give a goddamn. These are smelly brown people to them. The level of sadism is in the stratosphere. They know they have broken the Iraqi people. Or they think they have. So, the man threw the shoe. So what? Torture the son of a bitch. Yeah. Yeah. This is from Andre. He writes, Mike, sadly, it's become a joke in the Western world. Facebook now has a group called the International Shoe Throwing Day. These are some posts on the page. Just shoe do you think you are? Great game. Dodge the shoe. Sad and creepy. Does the event really mean anything? When no one in mainstream media writes about what this man said as he threw the shoes, it's just another jackass stunt. Yeah, remember, Andre, remember what he said. You know, this is for the murder and mayhem, I'm paraphrasing, that you have caused. The children, the women, the people you have killed. Kay writes, Mike, I spent 15 years traveling extensively between the United States and Europe, primarily Germany and France, and I also lived and worked there for an extended period. The first thing I learned was that everything I had been told about the superiority of life in America was BS. I saw that Europeans enjoyed a standard of living on a par with that of the United States, and in many ways better. While Europeans generally don't live in McMansions or drive Hummers, they do enjoy benefits that Americans can only dream of. 6 weeks paid vacation per year, a 35-hour work week, an advocate who represents the worker when conflicts with management arise, and thorough workers' compensation programs, including extensive rehabilitation called CUR. Why does Werner the worker enjoy all of these benefits while Joe the plumber struggles to make ends meet? Simple. The strength of the German Gewerkschaften. Gewerkschaften, or unions. After several days of following the current auto manufacturing saga, it occurred to me that the United States is fast becoming a source of cheap labor for the German and Japanese car manufacturers, in the same way that U.S. corporations have outsourced millions of jobs to countries like China in order to get around basic worker protections, the foreign auto manufacturers are looking to the United States to increase their bottom line. The Republican senators representing the American South, where so-called right-to-work states are the norm, and there are no unions to demand even a few of the protections that German workers enjoy, are only too happy to comply. What they don't realize is that by doing so, they are putting the United States in the same category as China, Vietnam, and the Northern Mariana Islands. Or they just don't give a blank. If they're not stopped, it will only be a matter of time before Americans are, quote, enjoying, end quote, the standard of living found in those parts of the world. Maybe that's overly dramatic, but I'm really beginning to wonder. Okay, San Francisco. And also, somebody sent me, Spy from Space sent me a subject line, says the compassion of G.W. Bush, and then it's a photograph of the people who are trying to escape the flooding of Katrina. And the picture, the color picture, is 3, 4, 5, 7, 15, about 20 people wading through, in some instances here, neck-deep water, waist-deep water, carrying a few belongings on their heads. And according to the picture, as I'm looking here, most of the people in the picture are African-Americans. And then underneath the picture is this caption, a quote from George W. Bush. The blacks didn't come out for me, so they're not going to see much help from me. Jesus, God. And Bush wonders why he got, what, 3% of the black vote? You probably heard today that the Fed has reduced its benchmark interest rate to as low as zero. Now, this has been done before, not here, but it's been done by the Japanese. And it's reported as a surprisingly strong step that should make it cheaper for Americans to borrow on credit cards and pay their mortgages. Wait a second. Make it cheaper for Americans to borrow, to go into debt? Let me go on. Wells Fargo, Wachovia, and U.S. Bancorp immediately lowered their prime lending rates from 4% to 3.25%. And other banks would probably follow suit. Economists cautioned, though, that people frightened by the economy and worried about their own jobs may not feel like taking on more debt. Jesus Christ. Who is making these decisions? The Fed's action was unprecedented in the central bank's 95-year history, and Wall Street embraced it. The Dow Jones Industrials finished the day up 360 points, a gain of more than 4%. Yadda, 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 yadda. Well, Bruce Enberg, our economic affairs correspondent, Prairie 2, as he likes to be called, Bruce writes, "Hey, Mike, the Fed cut the overnight rate between banks to zero, lower than even the last Great Depression. Japan did this in the 90s, and it took 6 years for Japan to even start to recover. Of course, they hadn't totally destroyed their economy first. Japan also foolishly tried to bail their banks out first, just like the Fed has done. The Fed is pledging to buy up securitized debt, including mortgages, credit card debt, and other consumer debt, so that banks will lend more. But this is just more of the same bailout for banks. They got us into this mess by running a company store where workers are underpaid and fall further and further into debt. Their solution to the downward spiral caused by debt? Provide us with more debt. And where are they getting the money? They aren't even pretending anymore that they aren't just printing it. Since they're printing trillions of new dollars and they've done nothing to plug the drain to China, that's where the money's going to go. And what will China do with all the money that they are getting and have nowhere to spend? Something has to give. A new Obama appointment raises still more concern. Former Iowa Governor Vilsack will be Secretary of Agriculture. His entire experience with agriculture is taking campaign contributions from multinational predatory corporations. He was chairman of the Democratic Leadership Conference, a champion for NAFTA, and a firm believer in the flat earth economy. Groan, keep your shovel oiled, and don't let the canned goods freeze. Well, well, well. Yeah, I don't understand it either. If debt is the problem, why is the Fed making it easier for the American consumer, as Bush likes to refer to us, to get further into debt? This really is, isn't it? It really is an attack on us. As reported by one of the wire services, for years, cutting the funds rate had been the Fed's most potent weapon for snapping an economy out of trouble. But the recession seems to be worsening despite all the steps taken so far. Stephen Stanley, chief economist at RBS Greenwich Capital, said, quote, "The move will go down in the annals of Fed history. I nominate this one to be called the 'Who could ask for anything more?' statement. The Fed is throwing everything in its arsenal." End quote. Yeah, I heard that. I heard it today by a couple of people, commentators on some of the financial channels, that the Fed has decided to stop using a pop gun and go with a howitzer. Which begs the question: what happens when this doesn't work? What's the next step? I mean, seriously, what is? There seems to be no bottom to this, but there is a bottom. There is a limit to what manipulation can be, what sorts of manipulations can be affected against this so-called free market, right? I mean, there's only so many tricks that can be pulled before the whole damn thing collapses. Are you worried yet? Oh, man.
Rich and young, one might wonder what great things they've done to become the fortunate one. They're the happy members of the lucky sperm club. The only thing they have to do is be conceived. It's great to be a member of the lucky sperm club, living in the lap of lazy luxury.
Got the flying monkey right, Blues? Here's the cure, Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. You know, I was thinking today with these exit interviews that these two war criminals are providing to corporate media, Dick Cheney and George Bush. Thinking again about Cheney's sit down with Jonathan Carl, and Cheney, I don't know, man. Cheney saying, well, as we told you last night, during that interview, Cheney disagreed with Karl Rove's statement last week that if pre-war intelligence indicated Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, the U.S. would not have gone to war. Cheney argued that we would have gone in anyway, saying Hussein had a long reputation and record of having started two wars. Oh, Christ. Of having brutalized and killed hundreds of thousands of people, some of them with weapons of mass destruction in his own country, end quote. This is crazy talk. Cheney also told ABC that Guantanamo should remain open until the end of this so-called war on terror. He took credit for being the architects of torture. It's astonishing what these two bastards are doing, and I started thinking what they're admitting to. You know, what did Bush say the other night, Kathy, when he was asked by Martha Raddatz about al-Qaeda not being in Iraq before Bush put them there? And his attitude was, his answer was, so what? How does this work with all the death? Let's just not talk about Iraqi dead and maimed and blown to pieces and children. And I mean, we can't even go there. The numbers are too big. Our sense of morality or ethical conduct will not allow us to think about that. This is something where we have to hide from the horror that we have allowed these war criminals to commit in our names. We can't look at it. Okay, so let's just stick with American dead. You know, 4,000 plus American dead, 20,000 grievously wounded, their lives disrupted, if not ruined, for the rest of their lives. And for what? I think about the families, and I realize this is extremely maudlin. It's only because of the time of the year. You know, it's Christmas. Oh, gosh. You know, we all get together and sing songs around the spinet and put candles in the window and all this other stuff. You know, we need a little Christmas. We need a little Christmas. What about the families whose sons are dead? Based on the lies. I mean, everybody who is willing to open their heads now understands that George W. Bush forced this country into a war that had no basis in reality at all. That every single American who has died in Iraq died for Bush's ego so he could say, "Mine's bigger than yours, Daddy." That's what this was all about. And Bush and Cheney sit there and say, "Yeah, well, you know, I devised the torture, and you know, it was absolutely necessary to protect the guy." I mean, I can't. If I had a relative, a son, especially a son or a daughter, oh my God, who had been in the military when all this happened, and who got sent there and was killed, I hesitate even say on the radio what I would do, because I know what I would do. It's just, how do these families, whose sons, for the most part, daughters, to a lesser degree, but each death is 100% tragedy. It doesn't make any difference if it's a son or a daughter. The little kids, whose dads are gone, whose mothers are gone, for Christ's sake. The husbands that are gone. The wives that are gone. And Cheney and Rove and Bush sit down for these filthy, disgusting, corrupt interviews with television journalists who I don't understand why they don't say, "You know, Mr. Vice President, you committed a war crime by any definition." What is Jonathan Carl afraid of if he says that? What is Martha Raddatz afraid of? Martha Raddatz has more courage in one of her toes than George Bush has in his entire twisted body. What stops them? And then Cheney, after dropping his pants and doing his business all over ABC, goes on the Rush Limbaugh program, the one place where he knows that Rush will do for him what Monica did for Bill Clinton. And Cheney sits there through a so-called interview with the pig man. And God damn it! We are accepting this, if not as normal, but as something that's just going to blow right by. It's just going to blow right by. Ha, oh, Jesus, God.
Let me tell you about hard work. Minimum wage with a baby on the way. Let me tell you about hard work. Rebuilding your house after the bombs took them away. Let me tell you about hard work. Building a bed out of a cardboard box. Let me tell you.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
It's about 26 before the hour, and it's time once again for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Mm. Gather round, kitties. It's time once again for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Got your jammies on? It's a rainy night here in Georgia. What's it like where you live? Is it dark in your neighborhood? Tonight's Uncle Mike's Story Corner is entitled Transcending Trauma. It's written by Victor Lopez, and it is the winner of the College Student Essay Writing Contest for The Nation magazine, just announced tonight. This essay is the college winner of the nation's third annual student writing contest. Some contend that before I was born, my future was predetermined. My mother met my father in a mental institution where she was being treated for schizophrenia. I was conceived at that institution. By 1 year of age, I would be in my first foster home placement. My sister was born 1.5 years later. She, too, would enter the foster care system. We would be placed back with our birth mother several times a year. She would have a mental breakdown, and we would be thrust back into yet another foster care placement. There is a scar that remains above my left eyebrow that reminds me of the inadequacy of state oversight and concern. My mother, having a psychotic episode, thought I had turned into the devil and slashed me with a butcher knife. I was young, but understanding something terrible had happened, I ran for my life. A police officer found a bloody 6-year-old running down the road and rescued me. The state returned me to her home several times after that, and it wasn't until she failed to show up for court that the judge had had enough and terminated her parental rights. By then, my sister and I had been placed into other foster homes where we would eventually be adopted separately. With my exposure to 40 foster homes, 3 group homes, and finally adopted parents, I would ask this president, Obama, to focus resources and attention on improving mental health services for dependent children in this nation. The Sacramento Bee reports, quote, there are more than 500,000 children and youth in foster care in the U.S. Approximately 20,000 youth age out or emancipate from foster care each year, end quote. Most of these children will not receive the counseling, guidance, or training that young people need to survive in the world. They will rely on what is instilled in them in the system and will end up in jail, sometimes after committing terrible crimes. That system raises children to become criminals without access to the basic common sense knowledge necessary to succeed at work or school. They have no foundation to build solid family values, but they procreate, and when they bring their own children into the world, the cycle remains unbroken. They will be the responsibility of the state from birth to death. These are human beings who, given half a chance to live a good life, could flourish. All they require are resources and training to save them before they turn to a life of crime or drugs. We fight wars on drugs and terror. We have task forces, raids, and immense resources to apply to our problems. We have to attack the source of violence against children in society. It would be my request of the new president to commission a federal oversight panel to overhaul the treatment of those in foster care and others who cannot care for themselves. That panel would be made up of people who have been in foster care. They would not be misled by the clichés that are too often heard by those who have not experienced its horrors. There are atrocities that the human mind cannot comprehend. I was once pissed on by one foster sibling while being held by another. I watched the parents in that same home treat their biological children and their foster children differently. My caseworker wrote off my accusation, and it was not until years later when the foster parents were prosecuted for abuse that my claims were validated. I would ask the new president to speak to these individuals to gain perspective as he charges the panel to reconstruct the failing system. The new president should add competent staff to the already overworked state and private agencies. Because most caseworkers have more than 100 children on their caseloads, they have no time to give the youth for which they are responsible any kind of help or attention. Additionally, they would make sure that there would be well-staffed independence programs and funds established to make certain that the minor coming of age is well prepared to function as an adult. This board would assure that there are not just clever labels on reports such as independence, but that the youth are actually ready to brace themselves for the adult world. There is also a greater need for mental health services. We should have national health insurance that will pay for psychiatric care and better community resources for people with mental health problems. I was fortunate to be adopted as an adult. I'm now studying to become a journalist and attend a college in North Carolina where I receive above average grades and yearn for knowledge. I'm one of the fortunate few who, despite years of mental and physical abuse, have made it out to the other side of life reasonably intact. Though my nightmares haunt me when I sleep, those horrid dreams of yesteryear, when I wake in the morning, I am loved and supported. What will come of those precious souls hidden in lost statistics that will enter the system? What of those who will be released from foster care? What will become of them? Absent the emotional tools needed to survive, they will protect themselves at the cost of others with crimes and violence. When we look in the mirror of humanity, we need to help those broken-hearted angels see a glimmer of hope. To do less would be a crime against our nation's young. Another Uncle Mike Story Corner, this one written by Victor Lopez, entitled Transcending Trauma. Isn't that nice alliteration? Do you know what alliteration means? Do you know what trauma means? Do you know what transcending means? Victor Lopez, who was treated like a human being by so many people who listened to this radio program over the years when he was in prison, and who has a foster mother, or I'm sorry, an adopted mother, Elaine, in North Carolina, who I don't believe in angels, but if there is one, it would be Elaine, who adopted Victor, and he is now working. He's in school. He wants to be a journalist. And this evening, we found out, Elaine found out and emailed me and let Victor know he was on his way to work, that he had won the third annual Nation Magazine College Student Essay Contest. And you can read it. Go to thenation.com and click on the student. Is it Student Nation? You'll find it. Juan Williams. Remember Juan Williams, the... At one time, I guess, liberal on National Public Radio. He's referred to in Wikipedia as an American journalist, author, and radio and television correspondent, senior correspondent at National Public Radio. He has written a length for the Washington Post, regularly appears as a contributor on Fox News, and is an Emmy Award winner. Well, last night on The O'Reilly Factor, O'Reilly slammed Muntada al-Zaidi, the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at Bush, and said if he had been there, O'Reilly, he, quote, would have physically taken the guy down, end quote. Juan Williams agreed, but he widened his condemnation to Iraqis in general, who Juan Williams said were behaving like ingrates for not appreciating what the United States has done for them. This is what Williams said, quote, but on a serious level, how many American lives have been sacrificed to the cause of liberating Iraq? How much money has been spent while they're not spending their own profits from their oil? American money. So I just think it's absolutely the act of an ingrate for them to behave in this way. Just unbelievable to me. End quote. Jesus Christ. Last month, National Review's Andy McCarthy was similarly frustrated by Iraqis' failure to shower their occupiers with thanks and gratitude. Andy McCarthy wrote, quote, thousands of American lives and hundreds of billions in taxpayer funds have been expended to provide Iraqis the opportunity to live freely. And this despite the fact that, A, the U.S. interest in Iraqi democracy remains tenuous, and B, Americans were assured when the nation-building enterprise commenced that oil-rich Iraq would underwrite our sacrifices on its behalf. Yet, to be blunt, the Iraqis remain ingrates. That stubborn fact complicates everything, end quote. Even the nation's number one war criminal, George Bush, is confused about Iraqis' frustration. He told Bob Woodward, quote, I don't understand that the Iraqis are not appreciative of what we've done for them, end quote. Woodward explains he thinks we've done this magnificent thing for them. An Oxfam report from February this year put into startling focus what the U.S. invasion has really meant for Iraqis. More than 4 million Iraqis forced to flee, either to another part of Iraq or abroad. 4 million Iraqis regularly cannot buy enough food. 70% are without adequate water supplies. 28% of children are malnourished. 92% of Iraqi children suffer learning problems, mostly due to the climate of fear. And that doesn't even talk about how many we have murdered, how many we have burned to death, how many we have forced to watch their children die when they didn't slow down at one of our checkpoints and we riddled their cars with 50 caliber machine gun fire. The unemployment rate in Iraq is somewhere between 25 and 70%. And it just goes on and on. Oh, Juan Williams, a little bit more about Juan Williams when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Oops. Oh, that's all right. Never mind. Sometimes it happens.
One, two, three, four. Imagine. There's no heaven. Heaven.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more of Mike Malloy.
So Juan Williams joins the chorus of neo-fascist right-wingers who says the Iraqis are just ingrates because somebody threw a couple of shoes at Bush and they're ingrates. I understand Hezbollah is suggesting that the shoe thrower Muntadir al-Zaidi should be executed. Because he missed. Juan Williams. Iraqis in general are behaving like ingrates for not appreciating what the United States has done for them. Jesus Christ. Juan Williams, radio and television correspondent, senior correspondent for NPR, and also was disciplined by the Washington Post after several female employees at that paper claimed he directed sexually explicit and hostile comments towards them. Williams' letter of apologies read in part, quote, "Some of my verbal conduct was wrong. I now know that, and I extend my sincerest apology to those whom I offended." Williams also was a staunch defender of then-Supreme Court nominee back in 1991, Clarence Thomas, against allegations of sexual harassment brought against him by Anita Hill. And Juan Williams wrote in an op-ed column for the Post that Hill had no credible evidence to support her allegations against Thomas. This was while Williams was still under investigation by the Washington Post for his own behavior toward female colleagues at the paper. Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. And then I get this from Virginia and California, writing about Gwen Ifill tonight on the PBS NewsHour. Gwen, Virginia writes, Gwen interviewed two morons tonight who wrote a book on how to reinvent the Republican Party. It was pathetic. It was beyond pathetic. Gwen actually asked them why they thought the Republican Party did so badly this last election, and not one of them, not even Gwen, mentioned Bush's name, whom America now hates with a passion. Bush was barely mentioned. Why is even PBS still coddling and protecting George Bush? Any moron knows they lost because of Bush and the lies, yet none of them say this. None of them. I was apoplectic and sent them a piece of my mind. It was terrible. Virginia. I think the answer is fairly clear, with a few exceptions out here on the fringes of liberal talk radio. You know who the usual suspects are. You know who we are. Yeah, I say we. Everybody else in the country is a goddamn liar that's in media, or is terrified, or is an appeaser, or is a go-along, get-along, or is afraid of their career, or is a skunk, or is a traitor, or a turncoat, or a coward, or a son of a bitch. That's what mainstream media in this country is in the toilet, a toilet that the Republicans own, the corporate America owns. This ongoing attack on Obama. You know, I started the program with this tonight. It's just unending. Any associative bullcrap that they can hang on Obama because of Rahm Emanuel or Blagojevich or this one or that one, they're trying. And it's amazing how they do it. They report it as news. It's not goddamn news. The news was 2 weeks ago or whenever it was when Blagojevich was arrested and charged with what? I'm not even clear yet. Trying to sell a Senate seat. And then it started. That was the news event. Boom. But the people of Illinois want to get rid of him. They have mechanisms to do that. But it appears the mechanisms aren't working because he, literally, I'm not defending him. But according to law professors who understand this stuff a lot better than you or and I or some correspondent for ABC or NBC or CBS does, he hasn't done anything except talk. I get $1 million effing dollars for this. Oh, yeah. Blah, 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 blah. But the story is not Blagojevich, although mainstream media, national media, they try to make it like it's Blagojevich. But the subtext is really the text. The subtext being, but what about the connections to Barack Obama? Barack Hussein Obama. Huh? What about that? Come on, America. You dumb bastards. Look what you voted for. He's corrupt and he's not even in office yet. Everybody knows this. He knows this corrupt. Everybody's ever associated with this corrupt. Democrat, Republican, Jew, Gentile, man, woman, gay, straight. They're all corrupt. Wake up, America. He was going to be your hero? It started already. It started immediately after the Grant Park Chicago victory night when the man comes out with his wife and children and a million people in the park and God knows how many on television were moved by the fact that all of a sudden somebody who had not been poisoning and corrupting the country for 8 years was now going to be president. Can't have any of that. Let's get the Marines out to do DUI checks over the Christmas holiday. That'll be good. Let's start them in California. Let's pass Prop 8 to deny people the right to get married because the Christian sons of bitches in this country don't want them to get married. Let's try to get the American public even deeper in debt. Because that's what capitalism demands. You can't do capitalism on cash and carry. It doesn't work that way. That's entrepreneurship. That's something, but it's not capitalism. Capitalism is debt, massive debt, mountains of debt. And what happens when your target population can no longer absorb any more debt? Force them. Force the sons of bitches.
story in your eyes. It's been shining down upon me now.
Welcome back. 7 past the hour. The Molloy Show on Nova M Radio. Back momentarily to what the Fed did today and what the ongoing situation here. We've been in this crisis now, at least where we all knew we were in a crisis, for how many weeks? How much has already been spent to try to correct it, and what's happening? The cards continue to fall. The phony economic system in this country continues to collapse. I don't make any claim to understand fully what happened or what is happening or what will happen. I just know that in listening to people who seem brighter than I where it concerns this stuff, I hear nothing but negativity and fear and facts and figures that show debt beyond the ability of our economy and maybe the global economy to handle. So what does the Fed do today? Takes the steps necessary to get Americans to start buying on credit again, go in debt further. Who in the hell in this country, other than the upper 1%, has the kind of disposable income, any disposable income, that the Fed is now expecting us to go spend? Where is it? What in the hell are these people talking about? There has been no effort, none, zero, zilch, nothing to help us. It's all gone to corporations, the banking industry, the insurance companies, the gamblers, the ones who screwed us, the ones who devoured our savings, our 401ks, our pension plans, our health care system, just ripped it to pieces, and the sons of bitches continue, the Fed and the Treasury, to throw more money into that rat hole, that cockroach nest. And now this. Oh, well, we're reducing. What does that mean when they reduce the overnight rate to 0 or 0.25%? It means this. Your savings in a bank aren't worth a goddamn thing other than their face value, and you better get it out of a bank anyway and get it into a credit union before the banks go belly up. How much you think you're going to make on your savings? Huh? If the overnight interbank rate is 0, what are you going to make? Ray in Scottsdale writes, Mike, the feds need consumers to fall back, the Federal Reserve, needs consumers to fall back in line and consume. It's required in a capitalist system. They will worry about what to charge for money later. However, with last month's drop in consumer spending, the first ever on record, it sets a dangerous precedent. To refuse to spend money or take on more credit is equivalent to plantation slaves refusing to work the fields. We are the cash crop of the 21st century. Well, I'll tell you what. I don't, man, I'm reaching the end of my rope. How about you? Huh? And Kate T. writes, Dear Mike, of course it's an attack on us. And it's not just an attack on the general population, but a direct and focused attack on the baby boomers. No one seems to be pointing this out. And I know this sounds a little paranoid, but let me explain. We all hear that millions of people have been laid off or their jobs have been phased out. But what are the ages of these people? At the unemployment offices, almost everyone is gray-haired. In my opinion, this is not a coincidence. The baby boomers are going to be costing these corporate bastards money on the health insurance as they get older. They expect raises and benefits and a 40-hour work week and vacations and on and on and on. The baby boomers remember what unions were created for. The baby boomers are going to be expecting the money from their pensions, which the corporations have spent. The boomers would have been drawing down their 401k accounts instead of contributing cash to the company. Those are gone now. So we are of even less use to them. The boomers want their Social Security, which, by the way, we have paid into for our parents and ourselves, and which the federal government has given away. The boomers scared the hell out of the powers that be back in the 60s, and the power pigs will be damned if the boomers are going to get a thing. They wonder why the large pickups and SUVs and such haven't been selling for the past year. The answer is because the boomers who would be getting ready to retire and buying trucks to pull their trailers or boats to carry their campers are having their houses foreclosed on and looking for a job, any job with benefits. Besides, the best way to trash the society is target the largest segment of it. Big Oil thought they could push us to $5 a gallon. They broke us at $4 because someone forgot that we had already been squeezed dry by stagnant wages, soaring health care costs, and rampant corporate greed and political corruption. At least they were surprised by the timing, if not the outcome, Kate. Well, I agree that the segment of the population that is probably going to be... I can't even say that, Kate. I can't say that the boomers... People over the age of 60 are the ones that are going to be hurt the most. I have a good friend in the reverse mortgage business. He went out, learned all he had to learn, got financed, bonded, investigated, and opened up one of the first reverse mortgage operations here in the state, I think, certainly in the Atlanta area. And his first client was his own mother, who is 84, and he helped her get a reverse mortgage, which simply means that she gets a monthly income now and doesn't lose her house, and her heirs don't lose the house. But he tells me that the reverse mortgage industry now is what is keeping so many seniors from going right down the commode. And it's sucking the equity out of their homes, but why not? I don't think that the boomers or that group older than the boomers, the Depression era babies, the war babies, I think a lot of them are suffering. A lot of them are going to face hard times the last decade or two of their lives. But what about the younger people? What about the people in their 30s and 40s right now who have just started families, who have actual mortgages to pay, who have car payments to pay, who have escalating health insurance costs? At least people over the age of 60 or 62 or 65, whatever it is, have Medicare. The ones I'm really, really, really concerned about are the 30 and 40-year-olds, maybe because I have children in that age group. But what's going to happen to them? And what about the ones behind them? What about the teenagers and the 20-somethings who, step out into the world and take a look and say, okay, what do I do now? I just wonder, and again, it's because of my own personal ignorance. I just wonder how this happened. I mean, I know who the suspects are. The suspects are Republicans and capitalism. There is no question about that. None whatsoever. None. We didn't get to this point because of national health care or social democracy or democratic socialism or unions or working people or people who work for wages, people who actually do something for a weekly or a biweekly paycheck based on how much time they put in or what they produced. Or what their contract called for. No! We didn't cause this! But we're the ones, without any voice to the contrary, are being forced to clean it up. Son of a bitch. That doesn't compute, does it? That doesn't come out on the fairness scale. What the hell did we do? What, by we... I mean, the working class, the people who work for wages or salaries. What did we do? What did we do to bring this on? Somebody want to call in and tell me? We'll take some phone calls now. 800-989-1480. I'm Mike Molloy. This is NOVAM.
Relative, they bring you down. Oh,
doing talk radio right. From the left, it's more of Mike Malloy.
All righty. It is 21 past the hour. Let's do some phone calls here, starting with Jared, who is calling in from Maryland, listening on XM. Hey, Jared.
Yeah.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself there, Mike?
Good, good.
Oh, I don't know. I called your show because...
What?
I called your show because you've been talking about a lot of stuff. I've been listening to you for probably about, I'm going to say about 2 or 3 months. I just now got into it ever since the presidential election.
Right.
And the stuff that's been going on in the economy and uh-huh. things like that. Of course, even the housing boom, even whenever that happened. I'm from a small area. Been researching small businesses around the area, trying to start one myself, and researching income and stuff like that around the area. So the median income around my area is about $30,000. So it's kind of low compared to the rest of the United States. But the housing prices around here, some of just like maybe 15 miles up the area is like $1.5 million. And I mean, thinking about that over the last year, you know, what type of people are actually purchasing those homes, and why are they marketing them that high?
Right.
What you've been talking about kind of goes in line with that. You know, it's pretty much just the mentality that everybody around, even in my area and across the country, has been conditioned to think. And that's pretty much why two Bushes got in office. Mm-hmm. You know, not back to back, but that's why Clinton couldn't do what he could do or wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why Obama's not going to be able to do what he needs to do, because just the mentality of everybody in the country thinks that they're more entitled than the other person to get what they want, instead of actually spreading it around to make, you know, not a utopia type civilization, mm-hmm. but
sure.
You know what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, I do. I understand you perfectly. My hope is that that the American public has had enough, and that Obama will be able to succeed, maybe not to the extent that a real liberal or progressive would like him to, but certainly to a greater degree than any of these so-called conservatives, Republicans, right-wingers, you know, however you want to label them. I'm hoping that will happen, because the American public, for the most part, I'm not talking about the one half of 1% who can buy a $1.5 million house in an area where people make 30 grand a year. That person is so out of touch with reality and with the rest of us, it doesn't matter. That person's going to live a way that you and I can just think about.
Well, you kind of have to look at the way society is going in the country, and I'm not saying you have to agree, but you have to somewhat realize that the mentality of this country is the entitlement. Everybody feels that they're entitled to a certain thing. Like I was on Yahoo this today after. You know, right after I got done working, I can't remember the guy's name, but Saudi Arabia, the oil minister, I think it was, he said a fair price for a barrel of oil was $75. Now, where does he come up with that idea?
Well, that's a fair price to him.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, to him, that enables him to do what he needs to do to make himself happy.
Well,
where do people get off thinking that way? That's the reason why, like you said, the Bush crime family. Like,
well, we've contributed to it. The West, the oil consuming as opposed to the oil producing countries. We have been on this binge, Jared. Let's face it, for decades, and the Saudis or whomever. Whoever it is producing the oil, the Kuwaitis, the Saudis, the this, the that, they have raised their level of expectation to the point where, and their own personal indebtedness, based on the fact that it seemed like Americans, since we're talking about Americans, were willing to pay $40, then $50, then $70, then $80, then $100, then $120 a barrel, and then $140, and then $147.
Well,
and then all of a
sudden,
everything started to collapse. So that leaves.
Don't you agree that that's our own stupidity?
Well, yeah.
Even I've seen that 2 or 3 years ago, that house, like, my mom and dad, 10 years ago, for an acre of land in a two-story house, in my area paid $10,000 for this house.
Sure.
When other houses around the area were going for $140,000 and $150,000. Now, you could look at those houses and know that the income is not in the area to afford those houses.
Right, right.
This is why the housing boom, this is why the housing bubble bust. I mean, honestly, everybody's seen it coming. But, you know, I'm not just saying us as Americans, but us as a whole society should have been smart enough to understand that.
Well,
but we got caught up
but you
in
know,
the whole...
you know what? I think what happened, Jared, I think what happened was we relied on the rules we had on the books for oversight. The inspectors and the accountants, we relied on them because we have set our society up so that we could rely on them to kind of be watchdogs, to make sure that we didn't get screwed. The problem is, all of the regulators were in on it. The Bush crime family regulators, all of the rules were suspended. The rating companies, the people who are supposed to take a look at this and say, no, this is bad, this is good, they all betrayed us. So it's not like we are totally stupid. We have been put in a trick bag. And my question is, how long are we going to put up with this?
Everything is crumbling around me. Why does everything cost so much money? Could somebody please help out my family? My mom needs hearing aids, new shoulders and new legs. My dad needs a break. He works all day, every day.
Hey, Truth Seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, more of Mike Malloy.
Before the hour, back to your phone calls. Bob is calling from Tennessee, listening on the Internet. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Michael. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Yeah, I think you're doing great, actually. Good show. I was very much moved by the essay that you read from Victor. Transcending trauma. You know, the last 10 years of my teaching career, I taught in facilities for incarcerated youth.
Wow.
And I could tell you many stories, but I'd like to share one with you, because in our facilities we had children in state's custody that were not only there for criminal reasons, but transits, people who were awaiting placement in a foster home and such.
Yeah, just everybody lumped together.
Yes, it's strange. It's like 15th century. They put the criminals with the abused.
Yeah, or the poor people. Yeah,
yes.
Sure.
Well, let me tell you about Red. For confidentiality reasons, that'll be his name. He was 5 years old in Canada with his family, and there was a car wreck, and his parents were killed. He was in the car.
Mm-hmm.
He experienced the trauma.
Right.
He was eventually adopted by a family in Louisiana. He started school and got in trouble in school. Was picked up for vandalism as a elementary school child. He damaged some parked cars. The family moved to Tennessee. He was 17 when he came to me at the facility. He had been tracked through special education his whole life and told that he was stupid and unruly and beyond the pale.
Mm.
I worked with him for months. He had to go 7 times to pass his GED.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I got him to do it was because he was getting in fights all the time at the facility. I kept him after school. He watched TV sometimes while he was supposed to be cleaning the schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him watching this show, 911 Emergency. He was enraptured. He told me after I talked to him that he wanted to be an EMT, an emergency management technician.
Right.
I told him if he got his GED, he could do it.
Mm-hmm.
A year and a half later, I got a telephone call. He had been discharged. He went multiple times. We struggled. He passed his GED. I got a phone call. Said, Mr. Bruce, I just want you to know that I am now an EMT. I just graduated from a community college.
That's, wait a second. Hold on a second. There you are. Go ahead, Bob. I'm sorry. Bob?
Yeah.
I lost you there for a minute. Go ahead.
So I know how full your heart must be, Mike, about Victor. Because when we have any small part in someone's betterment, we share in it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a blessing that you have the kind of people on your show. You've been a guest in my house for 5 years now.
Oh, my. Yeah, and I've been telling you, I want you to clean the carpet a little bit, too. I'm getting tired of coming in there and seeing that spot on the carpet, okay? Hello?
Yeah.
I'm just teasing. Bob, I appreciate the fact that you've allowed me into your house for as long as you have. I really do. And yeah, you're right about the stories. If you've been directly involved in that, of course, I never have. My role has been extremely remote, you know, radio talk show host that sits out here in the dark and prattles on every night. And the people who responded to Victor did so for their own reasons, had nothing to do with me. I really respect the fact that you have worked right on the front lines with this and actually worked with some of these kids. We have a long way to go, Bob. I swear to God we do. Thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. Take care, Bob. Kevin is calling from Hartford, listening on Sirius. Hey, Kevin.
Mike, how are you tonight?
I'm all right. How you doing?
All right. I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Yeah?
Yeah, but I listen to you every night anyway.
Well, thank you.
And you're the best talk show host in America.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah.
I don't care what anyone says.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm serious. So anyway, I was calling because, you know, I know you're very open-minded, you know, and I want to run this idea by you. I mean,
okay.
You don't really think this economic crash happened by total accident, do you?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
I think the people who are on the front lines, who are making the billions and the tens of billions, the American money manipulators and investment houses, the people who were playing in this particular sandbox knew exactly what they were doing, and they also knew that eventually it would collapse.
Uh-huh.
And they also knew that eventually, when it did collapse, that the powers that be would make sure that it got rebuilt on our backs, because they don't want to see this country go socialist.
Well, don't you think it's a worldwide phenomenon, though, with globalization? I'm talking about the central banks that are all interconnected, and that if one goes under, they kind of all go under.
Well, you're getting over my pay grade now. International finance to me is just an absolute maze. I wouldn't know where to begin. But where it concerns this country, I think there was a deliberate, concerted effort to so cripple this society and our ability to circulate money, that it would mean an end to the programs that were started
right.
80 years ago, that are socialist in nature, democratic socialism,
yep.
that are valuable, that do mean a sustainable life to so many people, and to predatory capitalists, which is every single Republican, even though it's against his or her own interest, their goal is to destroy everything that has the least bit of union or government or regulatory
right.
involvement. So, yeah, I believe it would. Like I say,
well,
I can't.
Let me say one last thing, because I think this is very important for all those pro-American war hawks, that, you know, the United States in Afghanistan, Iraq, and we didn't Vietnam was still, we were still paying back for Vietnam War before the Iraq War and Afghanistan. And now, you know, now we're borrowing this money, and actually there's currency wars going on, and we're not winning a currency war in a global market. That's where we're getting our ass kicked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, sooner or later, the people that we're borrowing our money from want the money. You know,
well,
and the credit rating of the United States keeps going down and down and down.
So
people that want these wars on borrowed money better wake up too.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. We're right on the rim of the commode, and it's been flushed, and that water is swirling around. We're about to be sucked down. As far as the deliberate destruction in this country, and your reference, well, what about, you know, globalization, the rest of the central banks, the rest of the world? I'm sure that's a possibility. That's a question that we ought to address to Bruce, our economic affairs correspondent. But my point is, you know, I've got kind of a provincial attitude here, not cosmopolitan at all. We're the ones that had FDR. We're the ones that were perched on the verge of revolution and chaos in this country back in the late 20s, early 30s. And it was FDR, an American, who worked with the American system and the American this and the American that, and instituted all sorts of things that only exist here in order to, you know, whether it's FDIC or you know, whatever it was. All these programs that were put together by Franklin Roosevelt and then built upon by subsequent Democratic administrations, who made sure that returning military people had the right to go to college on the jail. You know, just on and on and on. That's why I can only localize this. I can only make this an American problem for me to deal with. I couldn't even begin to think about the economic structures or the societal structures or the legal structures of other countries. You're probably right. It probably is all tied together. But I think the real murderers in this country, the real predatory capitalists, understood exactly, just like this guy, the former head of NASDAQ, who now has been charged with running the largest Ponzi scheme in the history of the civilized world, I guess. $50 billion disappeared. I mean, of course he knew what he was doing. Of course he did. Certainly he did. And he also knew that when his house of cards collapsed, he was going to pull down all kinds of businesses and charities and individuals and investment houses that believed in him. This kind of stuff doesn't happen by accident. Not ever.
For a supper, wondering what's become of me. I got a 008 Tina Martin guitar in the backseat of the car. Hey, I am leaving Mississippi with the radio on. Cause we can't find a friend, still got the radio.
Ten before the hour, thanks to our gang, Ian Huff, Ben Burt, Sharon Gordy, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Bruce Enberg, and our executive producer, Catherine Bay. Nancy in Ohio writes in regarding foster care. Mike, I've worked in the field of foster care residential treatment for kids all of my career. The guy who just called in, that would have been Bob, hit the nail on the head as to what works for kids. They need an adult who takes an interest in their life and supports, loves, and cares for them. I keep in touch with one of the kids I worked with 20 years ago. She was horribly abused and lived through the suicide of her father. She attempted suicide herself several times. We had dinner recently. My family and I had dinner with her, her husband, and her child. She now works in social work, has a master's degree, and tries to do for others what people did for her. I was a bit player in her life, but I'm so proud to know that I helped her in some way. By the way, when I started work in the field with a bachelor's degree, I made exactly one-third of what my friends were making in engineering with their bachelor's degrees. Go figure. We pay for what we value, right? Nancy in Ohio. I have a cousin, Nancy, in Ohio. Anyway, thanks, Nancy. And this from Sarah. Mike, on January 1st, 2008, that's last January, at the Rose Bowl Parade, I, along with Cindy Sheehan and the White Rose Coalition, protested the invasion. Items were thrown at us, Ms. Sheehan was pushed, and I was nearly arrested for wearing an orange poncho with a sticker which read, "Impeach Bush and Cheney." So much for liberty and freedom. My soul aches for the lives sacrificed for what you succinctly expressed as George W. Bush saying, "Ha ha, Daddy, mine's bigger than yours." I'm the mother of a serviceman, and I can barely stand it. I barely eat, fraught with worry. I'm like the living dead from grief and worry. I wonder about the vaccines they force upon our sons and daughters and their exposure to munitions in Iraq. I just don't know, Mike. Our children live in such a monstrous world. God cannot exist. It is amusing, and I chuckle each time I hear the phrase, "God bless America." Sarah. Yeah. And this is kind of old, but Sheila just sent it in to me. The former British Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, you remember him? In the Blair government. This is what he said a couple of years ago, quote, "The truth is, there is no Islamic army or terrorist group called Al-Qaeda. And any informed intelligence officer knows this. But there is a propaganda campaign to make the public believe in the presence of an identified entity representing the devil, only in order to drive the TV watcher to accept a unified international leadership for a war against terrorism. The country behind this propaganda is the United States." Former British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook. Yeah, we lose, I'd completely forgotten that, too. Thanks, Sheila. We lose sight of the fact that the whole Al-Qaeda myth, rumor, is garbage. It is total garbage. Everybody in the Middle East knows it. Some informed Europeans know it. I'm sure that informed Canadians know it. But in this country, you see, in this country, in the United States, we have been bitch slapped and abused and kicked around like a $2 a trick whore by our pimp, no offense to sex workers, for so long now. With the color-coded terror alerts and the fact that we have to take off our goddamn shoes just to get on an airplane. I mean, when you think of what they have done, plus allowing this attack to occur on our soil on September 11, 2001, at the very least allowing it to occur. The constant talk, the constant threats, the turning us into a nation that tortures, turning us into a nation of goddamn international outlaws, every single one of us. We put these people in power. Oh, yes, we did. We put them in power because we allowed them to go into power without standing up and saying, no, you're not. You lied and cheated. You're not going to be the president. You're not going to be the cabinet. You're going to be the vice president. You didn't get any political capital, you little weaselly bastard. So the rest of the world sees us as allowing this to have happened. And they understand, I think, to a far greater degree than we do. Al-Qaeda, Al-Shmaida, there is no such thing. There never has been. What there has been for the past 8 years is a group of war criminals, sons of bitches, predatory capitalists, mind-blowing sociopaths who have run this country into a brick wall. And they've done it with impunity. Nobody. Nobody has made a concentrated, organized effort to stop them. Nobody. None of our institutions have come to the rescue. Not our Congress, not our court system, not our education system, not our philosophers, not our artists, not our military. No one. And damn sure not you and me. Where is this going to go? I have no idea. Do you? I have no idea. You know, I certainly am not nominating myself to sit here and kick everybody's ass every night, including my own. I'm not going to do that. But I think we have to we have to recognize the degree to which we've allowed this to happen. Economic meltdown, societal meltdown, international relations meltdown, warmongering, renegade, rogue country that we've become. Jesus God. I don't know what's going to happen. Do you? I hope we pull out of this. I hope as our jet that was cruising along at 39,000 feet and has gone into a serious nosedive and we're just about to get ground rush and lose the whole thing. I hope one of us or a group of us can get the controls and pull out of this. I'll see you tomorrow night. I'm Mike Malloy. Keep it lit. This is Nova M Radio.